Welcome to the Jambase Podcast, which is proudly part of the Osiris Podcast Network. I'm Scott Bernstein, and co-hosting with me today is Andy Kahn. Hey, AK.
Hey, everybody. Hey, Scotty B.
Andy and I will soon get started with our usual show opening segment, The Rundown, where we'll discuss recent notable news items. Following The Rundown will be Andy's interview with Neil Cassell, who will discuss his musical mentors with AK backstage at the recent Summer Camp Music Festival. We'll get started with The Rundown in just a second, but first, I wanted to tell you about our sponsor, NugsNet. NugsNet is the destination for live music on demand. They have a growing collection of over 15,000 full-length concert recordings from bands like Widespread Panic, The String Cheese Incident, and Pearl Jam, so you'll never run out of live music to explore. You can listen to a show from last night or from 40 years ago. The beauty is that Nugs keeps on expanding their roster, and one of the latest additions is Wilco. I've been geeking out on Jeff Tweedy banter from Wilco shows over the past few weeks. It's available on desktop, iOS, and Android apps, as well as Sonos and Blue OS. Just like us, the folks at NugsNet are live music fanatics, so they're offering new subscribers a 35% discount on an annual subscription. Go to nugs.net/jambasepodcast and sign up today. If you already have a subscription, give the gift of live music to a friend. Again, nugs.net/jambasepodcast for 35% off an annual subscription. All right, Andy, let's get to the rundown.
Well, unfortunately, we're starting on a very somber note and the death of Jeff Austin, who passed away this week at the age of 45. Jeff was a co-founding member of Yonder Mountain String Band and was the group's mandolin player from 1998 until he left in 2014 to pursue a solo career that included his forming the Jeff Austin Band. Jeff was also part of several projects like 30 dB with Humphreys McGee's Brennan Bayless and the recent Grateful Ball bluegrass tributes to the Grateful Dead with the Traveling McCurries. There's a fund set up for Jeff. If you want to donate, go to sweetrelief.org/Jeff-Austin-Fund. All of us at Jambase share our sincere condolences with Jeff's family and friends and with the Yonder family. I just want to say thanks to Jeff for sharing his music and his energy with us. I first saw Jeff with Yonder not long after he and the band started, and I have distinct memories of being mesmerized by his mandolin playing and his captivating stage presence. When I think of Jamgrass, a few bands and musicians immediately come to mind, and Jeff Austin is certainly one of the first. Jeff gave it all on stage, and I'm truly going to miss getting the chance to witness that again. But as I said, our thoughts and our condolences are with Jeff's friends and his family.
It's been such a tough few days, and I just wish Jeff was around to see all the love that's been shown his way from all corners of the jam world and beyond. I mean, CNN, Rolling Stone, and People all covered Jeff's passing, which is another display of what Jeff meant to fans and other musicians. It's just so surreal he's gone. You know, moving on to our next rundown topic, Dead & Company guitarist John Mayer played late Grateful Dead guitarist Jerry Garcia's famed Wolf guitar during Dead & Company's show this past weekend at Citi Field in New York City. After the show, Mayer posted a note on Instagram that read, "It wasn't time until it was. New York City, we were all holding Jerry's guitar tonight. I cherish the responsibility. All I care about is that I might help take you where you're going, where you're looking to go. Thank you for your kindness and your trust. An unforgettable night." John also thanked photographer Jay Blakesberg for facilitating Wolf making it into his hands. Blakesberg worked with Wolf's current owner, Brian Halligan, and handler David Meerman Scott to get Wolf to Citi Field from the nearby Met, where it's on display as part of the museum's Play It Loud Instruments of Rock and Roll exhibit. Mayer and Wolf led his bandmates on a show opening St. Stephen, which was one of many classic Dead tunes played on Sunday night. Second set opened with Scarlet Begonias into Fire on the Mountain, and midway through Fire, the PA at Citi Field cut out. The band seemed to still hear through all of their equipment, and they kept playing through and didn't even realize for a while the malfunction. And it was kind of a cool scene that developed as the audience began to sing in unison with the band. I highly recommend checking out a video from as far away from the stage as possible. Just watch all of the stadium chanting Fire on the Mountain. And the PA dropped out again during the drums part of the set, but the Rhythm Devils were still loud enough for the crowd to hear. It's always great to see Wolf in action and hear its distinct tone.
It sure is, Scotty. All right, let's move on to the next rundown topic, which is the long-awaited start to the Rolling Stones' No Filter Tour of North America. The tour was supposed to happen earlier this year, but it was postponed after 75-year-old frontman Mick Jagger underwent and recovered from heart surgery. The Stones have so far played two shows at Soldier Field in Chicago. Opening night set list included the band's first performance of Sad, Sad, Sad since 2002. The shows have featured a B-stage and acoustic renditions of Angie and Dead Flowers on night one, and Play With Fire and Sweet Virginia the second night. That's not all the Stones mixed up setlist-wise during the second show. They played seven songs they didn't play at the tour opener, including the first Monkey Man in 12 years. The tour continues throughout June, July, and August, so we'll have to wait and see what's in store for the rest of the way. It's time now to check in on all things Phish Tour. Scotty, you had the pleasure of catching Sunday's show at Merriweather Post Pavilion, which was also your birthday. So did the age-old adage, never miss a Sunday Scotty B birthday show, ring true?
It sure did, Andy, though not quite in the way I was expecting. I was thinking there'd be bust outs, but I was treated to a show that was heavy on improvisation, especially in the second set, and there's nothing wrong with that. I had a really cool experience in that not only did I go to the show with one of my best friends, also went with a guy who was seeing Phish for the first time, and getting to live vicariously through his experience and see him get his mind blown by all of the songs they played was such a cool experience and made me really appreciate what we have. One thing that I noticed is Mike and Trey are now wireless, and man, Trey had this shit-eating grin on his face the whole show, and the vibe in Fishland is really good. It was really weird. They played Gumbo in the first set, and it just kind of came to a halt. And I said to my buddy Stanch that was standing next to me, I said, that's got to be the only time ever they haven't ended Gumbo with Paige's solo or with the horns playing what Paige normally plays. And just like that, they picked up from where they left off and gave Paige his chance to shine. There was a six-song second set. Everything's Right was everything that I hoped it would be when they debuted that song. And the same is true with Ruby Waves, a Ghost of the Forest song that thankfully has made it over to Fishland. And cool four-song encore, kept the music going till right a minute before curfew. So it was a great experience. Glad I did it, and looking forward to some more Phish later this summer. That's all for the rundown. Andy's musical mentor's chat with Neil Casal is next, right after he tells us about our sponsor, CBD Vermont.
CBD Vermont partners with organic farms in Vermont to produce organically grown hemp used in full-spectrum extracts that are available for sale at cbdvermont.com. Use the code JAMBASE, that's J-A-M-B-A-S-E, at checkout to get 15% off all of their products. CBD Vermont guarantees their farms a price per plant and provides cultivation support throughout the growing season. There are a lot of CBD products out there, so how do you know what you're getting? Well, CBD Vermont tests all of its extracts to ensure you're getting the right amount of CBD and other cannabinoids and no unwanted toxins. Plus, each batch is traced to the Vermont farm where it was grown and the hemp cultivar that was extracted. They've recently launched an online store where you can buy Vermont-made CBD products, including oils, capsules, edibles, and topicals that have been fully vetted by the staff at CBD Vermont. I've been a champion of the benefits of CBD for several years now, and I'm really impressed with the quality of products CBD Vermont offers. One of the most difficult things has been finding a source for CBD that I can trust to provide consistent products that I know are from a high quality source. What I like about CBD Vermont is knowing the amount of care and concern that goes into their wide variety of products. Go to CBDVermont.com and use the code JAMBASE, J-A-M-B-A-S-E, at checkout and get 15% off. All right, now let's hear my musical mentor's chat with Neil. I am at summer camp with Neil Casal. He just played a VIP set with Chris Robinson. He's here with the Chris Robinson Brotherhood. We're gonna play another set here in a little bit. Exciting stuff. Thanks. You're also playing with O'Teal and Friends tonight, right?
Yes, I am.
Awesome. Exciting. That's a.
It really is.
A couple of great sets to look forward to tonight. I'm excited. So we're here for the Jam Bass Podcast and the Musical Mentors segment. So we're going to talk to you about how you got started, go back to the early days, and figure out what some of your influences were. I always like to start with, what was your first instrument?
My first instrument was guitar. It was an acoustic guitar, an Ovation Applause was the model.
Do you still have it?
No, I don't. Yeah. No.
How did you get the guitar?
I was 12 or maybe 13. I guess I was just turned 13 and or maybe 12, I don't know, but Christmas was coming up soon and my dad asked me what I wanted for Christmas, and the first Atari systems were just kind of taking over the world. It was a huge sensation, the very first Ataris, and I wasn't really into that, but I didn't know what to say, so just to kind of keep up with my friends, I said, I guess I want the Atari, you know, like everyone else. And my dad could hear the half-hearted answer in that. And also just, he didn't like things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. He liked things that you could actually, you know, learn or get really something from, you know.
A real skill.
Yeah, right. So he was like, Neil, I try to never say no to you, which was true. He was a great mm-hmm. supporter and friend of mine. He wasn't a strict guy, but he was like, you know, this is just not cool, this Atari thing. You know, you're going to get into it for a couple months and it's going to collect dust in a closet, you know, for the mm-hmm. rest of time. So you really, I want to get you something that you can like develop a skill from or learn or, you know, make use of. And he said, well, I see you reading all the time. You know, do you want more books or, you know, anything that's useful. I see you listening to music all the time. Do you want more records, cassettes, whatever? Do you want to play an instrument? You know, he was just throwing things out there. Uh-huh. And my eyes lit up at play an instrument.
Oh, cool.
It had never occurred to me before to ask for that. I don't know. I just guess I thought I couldn't do it or something. And but I'd always dreamed of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, there you go. That's something. I can tell that piqued your interest. You know, what do you want? Anything, man, anything but the Atari, you know. Drums, clarinet, trumpet, sax, bass, guitar. So my eyes lit up at guitar, and he got me one for Christmas, and I never looked back, you know.
So did you start taking lessons right away?
I did, yeah. I took lessons from a guy named Mel Dworkin. I was from a little town in Rockaway, and Mel Dworkin gave me my first lessons. Yeah.
So how long do you think you took lessons from him?
Not very, only a few months.
Did you end up taking lessons from somebody else then, or did you, or was that the end of
your I took lessons at various points along the way, but I had a decent ear, mm-hmm. you know, right away, and the music I was into, I could kind of figure out.
What music was that?
I was, I was really into the Rolling Stones at that time. I was obsessed with them.
Sure.
They were my band, and they totally just fired. You know, they just got my imagination going, and I read books about them and looked at pictures of them and listened to all their records, and I was into reading about the people that they liked, all the blues artists, you mm-hmm. know. So yeah, I was the, I mean, I've told this story many times before, but I got, you know, two things that Christmas. I got my first guitar, and I got a copy of Exile on Main Street. So yeah, once I started,
the rest was history.
Yeah, that was it for me. Yeah, that kind of, my life was set right there.
So did you set out learning all the licks right away?
Well, you know, I got into the countryside of that record, you know, the sure. Sweet Virginia and Torn and Frayed and all that. Mm-hmm. I couldn't play those. I mean, later I came to realize what an incredibly dense and detailed, you know, and nuanced and difficult record that is to sure. actually play. It's nearly impossible, really, to get it right. I mean, no one can even come close. But, you know, the general song forms I could figure out pretty quickly. So I stopped taking lessons. I mean, I wish I'd stuck with them, really. Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea now. But I just started playing on my own and learning.
Did you start writing songs then?
Not right away. It took me a few years before playing guitar before I started writing.
Was anybody a mentor in that aspect?
Songwriting? No. I mean, not anyone locally that I knew. There wasn't anybody writing any good songs. You know, there probably was, but I didn't know them in my town. So, no, my songwriting mentors all came from records. I had a couple of guitar mentors, but not songwriting ones.
Well, tell me about the guitar mentors then.
Well, my first one was a guy his name was Todd Schofield, but he later became known as Todd Youth, and okay. You can look him up. He became kind of a punk legend. I played with him for a short time when I was like 14, and he showed me a lot of really useful things on the guitar, things that I use to this day. You know, he was the first person that showed me a double stop. And Todd was he was younger than me, but he was very advanced, kind of in everything. He was just a fast moving kid. Mm-hmm. He was a good guitar player, good bass player, and he showed me a lot of my first, like, I don't know, really cool licks on guitar that I still use. And he ran away from home at a very young age, and he moved into New York, and he was a part of that hardcore scene mm-hmm. in New York in the mid, you know, to late 80s.
Okay.
There's incredible photographs of him from that time. He played with a million bands, I think like Agnostic Front and all these insane bands, and he knew everybody, and mm-hmm. he later played with Danzig and
oh, wow.
even Ace Frehley and all the I think even like Glenn Campbell. He did all wow. of these things, yeah. And I lost track of him for years and years, and I think through Facebook or something we got back in touch a few years ago, and then he passed away last year, which is a bummer. But yeah, he was in the first band I was ever in, was with Todd.
What was that band called?
Oh, I don't even know. We were just like we just jammed in a basement, you know. We had a friend named Rich Kennedy, and we just kind of lived in his basement for a year and just played Black Sabbath songs. And you know, I was a horrible guitar player, really. I was just mm-hmm. terrible. Yeah, I wasn't good at all. But I kept trying, and then later when I was 17 or 18, there was when I just graduated high school, or was just graduating high school, I met a guy, his name is Davis Janes, and by that time I was like, had gone through this kind of metal phase, you know, because it was the mid 80s in New Jersey where I lived, and it was just part of what was happening.
Sure.
And I was dazzled by some of those guitar players and that music, but it wore off rather quickly. Because I really couldn't play that stuff very well. And after a while, I just didn't want to. And I returned back to blues and things that the Rolling Stones had led me to. And then I was really into, like, you know, Mick Taylor and Peter Green and those British blues players. And I met a guy who at the time was about 20 years older than me. He seemed ancient then, but now it's just a laugh to think that someone who was 37 seemed really old to me.
Right.
But, you know, he had played with Leslie West, and he was, you know, growing up in the 60s, like, he went to the Fillmore East all the time, and he saw Cream and all of these bands, and he knew so much about music. And he managed a guitar store called The Music Maker, and I went to work for him right after I graduated high school. And he was the true mentor to me. He showed me about touch and tone and taste and, you know, minimal playing. And, like, I really got my biggest lessons from Davis. And I'm still in touch with him to this day.
Are,
and no one ever got to know him, but he's really one of the greatest guitar players I've ever heard. I mean, to hear him solo was a thing of beauty.
So what were the interactions like with him? Like, how did he show you these things? Were they formal lessons, or was it more casual things? Was it listening to other music and playing?
Yeah, it was listening, and it was casual settings, but he was very hard on me.
Really?
Yeah, very. Because I had been in this, like, some high school bands, and kind of thought I was a hot shot, and I graduated high school. I didn't go to college, you know, because it just wasn't in the cards for me on every level. And it was kind of a rough time. I mean, it was the late 80s in New Jersey. I was, you know, what was going to happen to me? I mean, there weren't many, the opportunities were pretty bleak, really. And I wanted to be a guitar player so bad that I would just, you know, I stopped at nothing to do it. And I wasn't that good, really. And I wasn't learned. I didn't study. I don't know what I was doing. I was so committed to the idea of it. And I played all the time. And anyway, Davis, I worked for him in this music store, and there was, like, a little studio in back. And, after work, he was great. You know, he stayed with me. He saw something in me, you know, he really did.
Yeah,
he saw whatever potential was there, you know, and he would have these talks with me, like, you know, you think you're nothing, man. Like, you just live in this little crappy town. You know, if you think you're going to get anywhere, man, you better start working hard, you know.
Destroy the ego.
Yeah, like, you forget about whatever you think is cool, because you're not cool. This isn't cool. You're playing, you have, you know, you're good, but you're not that good. So
definitely not great.
Yeah, you're, like, you haven't learned anything yet. So he would just destroy me. I mean, he really was hard on me. But then, you know, he would, like, say complimentary things. And so it wasn't just abusive, but it was tough. And, like, he would, you know, I remember he'd turn the lights out and say, now play, you know.
Oh, wow.
Just things like that. Yeah. Yeah, but he was tough on me playing-wise, very hard on me, and I'm very thankful for that, you know, because during that year that I worked for him, I progressed really fast, you know, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Not in a guitar, not in a music school kind of way. It was a different kind of learning, you know.
Just
it was
maturity, like.
Yeah, it was just learning about, like, what rock and roll really is, you know, and he knew that stuff, and he just got me deeply into it. And
you said
it helped.
Still in touch with him?
Yeah.
Do you still consider him, like, a mentor figure?
Oh yeah. He's the biggest mentor I've ever had,
like,
musically.
When you talk to him, is he still giving advice?
Oh, totally. Yeah. No, I always tell him, man, you're the greatest, you know, thank you, and I love you, and you're the best thing that ever happened to me. And he says, oh, look at all the things you do. You know, he's all proud of me and stuff. But I had other mentors too, you know. Right after Davis, I played in a band called Blackfoot, which with a guy named Rick Medlock, who has been in Lynyrd Skynyrd for you know, years, and is kind of famous, you know.
Sure.
And Ricky was a great, it's very, like, people that don't or only know me from this jam world are always shocked when they hear that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I played with Rick Medlock, and he was another incredible mentor to me. in the same ways that Davis was, you know, but he didn't, Ricky wasn't hard on me. We just played in a band together. I mean, I joined his band and we just got straight on the road. And he was so cool, you know, he just like was helpful. And it was more by example because yeah. Rick was just doing it every day. And like he had had a lot of success.
And did he see like the professional side of things? Like,
I saw the professional side and I saw the, you know, the weird dark side of like, mm-hmm. not him.
Just the business?
Well, yeah, the business and also just like being on the road, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the first touring I ever did was with Rick, you know. And like things were hard for him at that point. It was like, yeah, it was like the late 80s, you know. He'd had a lot of success in the 70s and early to mid 80s. And at that time was in a pretty big dip in his career. Mm-hmm. He would later rise out of that and, you know, look where he is now. Right. But at that time, I mean, he was still killing it, you know, but it was just tough. Like, so just playing these weird clubs in 1989 in the deep South, you know, and that's all sure. I wanted to do. Yeah. Like,
it had to be unfamiliar.
Yeah, I was in heaven, though, really, yeah. because, yeah, to me, the South was, that's where all the, like the roots of all the music that I loved came from, and I wanted to go there, and he took me there, and that was great. But there was a lot of weird people and a lot of scrappy things going on. Again, not with him, he had his mm-hmm. shit together, mm-hmm. but just around, you know, it was a very weird place for a young man to be like me. It was, yeah, and it wasn't, it was, it wasn't like I was in this band and we had some hits. I mean, it was just mm-hmm. kind of, it was like pretty rough and tumble now that yeah. I think about it. Yeah. I can't really even believe that I, you know, did all that now. But Ricky was a cool, great guy, great mentor. He just showed me what to do by being himself. And I'm still friends with him too, you know? Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't seen him in years and I saw him about a year ago and we had a really great, reunion. Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, I could talk. I have many mentors. There's Andy Gessling from Railroad sure. Earth. Yeah. I mean, he's probably a little closer to our scene here. Mm-hmm. And that's something, if anyone's interested in me, Andy was one of my biggest mentors as well. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. That's a terrible thing to have, to not have him around.
Yeah, it sure seems like it.
Because I thought he was, for all of us who knew him, we just thought he was going to be here forever, you know? Yeah, but I'm from that same area in New Jersey where, you know, Railroad is from and a band called From Good Homes that, mm-hmm. you know, he and Todd, who were such a great band. And like at that time, I was just learning about acoustic music and acoustic guitars and how to play them. And Andy was a mentor to me on acoustic guitar in the way that Davis had been on electric.
Okay. Gotcha.
And Andy turned me on to the Incredible String Band, and he told me the difference between certain acoustic guitars and what a good one was and what a bad one was. And I would go to his house and just, we would play and I would listen to instruments all night long, and he'd say, check this out now, here's what you want to look for.
That's fascinating.
Here's what you don't want. And he recorded my early demos and we did gigs together, and he was such an incredible person and a very funny person as well. He had an amazing quiet sense of humor that if you like, once you tuned into it, you know, Andy always had this like a little smirk, you know, about him, and he saw the great humor in the world, and I loved him so much, and he's very important to me, and everyone, mm-hmm. everyone that he ever played with or came in contact mm-hmm. with, you know, he really made this lifelong impression on. I'm sure everyone says the same. We all say the same things about him. So
he sure seemed like a
special yeah, person. Man, he was really magical guy, you know, and I got to speak with him a couple weeks before he passed. So, and I told him, man, you're my dude, you know, you're my mentor forever. And, I was glad I got to tell him that.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we should probably wrap it up unless there's anybody
I already,
else. Well, I'm not supposed to keep you much longer.
Well, you can keep me as long as you want. It's totally fine.
I'd love to. This is fascinating stuff, man.
You can ask me more questions.
If there's more.
Sure. Yeah, no one's reaching out to me right now, apparently.
How about this? Have you been a mentor for anybody?
I don't know. I'm not sure about that.
I think you've got a pretty decent resume yourself. You've done studio work. You've worked with quite a few different bands and stuff. Yeah. I wonder if people ever come to you for advice.
I don't think so. I mean, well,
is it casual? I mean, you know, like in a backstage setting like this, maybe something gets posed.
Oh, I mean, I've had people say very nice things to me. Sure. You know, but I mean, well, this kid came up the other night, or I think his mom or his aunt was with him, and he was a few feet away and seemed like he was nervous to speak to me or something. And she said, "Oh, well, he wants to talk to you. He's, you know," turns out he was just graduating high school, and Big Moon Ritual, the first CRB record, which came out in 2012, which is a long time ago now.
Which just made the Jam Bass 20 for 20 list of the top 20 debut albums of the past 20 years.
Wow, really? Oh, I didn't realize that.
Came out last week. So,
that's nice. This kid just starts talking to me, and he says, you know, told me that his father turned him on to that record when it came out, and he was whatever he was, 12 years old or something, and he hadn't listened to much music at that point, some hip hop, some thing, country, whatever, but like was unfocused about music. And he heard that record, and that's what it changed his life and got him into rock and roll. And now he plays guitar and he's knows all these records, and like that was the entrance for him. So that was amazing to hear. I'm starting to produce some younger artists. And
so have you had any mentors in the studio? Like, how did
absolutely
how did you learn your way around a studio?
I have one really big studio mentor, and his name is Jim Scott.
Okay.
And he is a great producer, engineer, legendary guy who he produces Tedeschi Trucks records and
wins Grammys.
He wins Grammys. He was, you know, engineered Wildflowers, the Tom Petty record. Right, yeah. I mean, Johnny Cash record.
His resume is pretty impressive.
It's pretty astounding, really. So Jim Scott is my studio mentor.
How did you meet him?
I met him in the early 90s. I've known him a long time, probably 1990 or 91.
Oh, okay.
This guy who manages him and me still, this guy named Gary Waldman, who's a part of this jam world too, through a lot of people. Gary was working for a label at the time, knew Jim, and said to Jim, "Oh, I'm working with this kid, check out his demos." And Jim immediately said, "I really like this." So Jim and I became friends and started working together, doing demos, 1993, 4. He produced my first record. John Ginty John Ginty and I were like musical partners for years. You know, we came up together, learning everything together. John and I met on the like Wetland scene back then.
Gotcha.
You know, John now, he played with Citizen Cope and Robert Randolph, and he's in the Almond Betts band. So John and I started working with Jim Scott at that time. And Jim just showed us everything because he was in LA making wildflowers, you know, and he would like play us little pieces of it while they were working on it, you know.
So cool.
And he just really said to us, like, and it was kind of the same thing that Davis did to me years before, like, all right, you know, you guys want to, you want to do this for real? Mm-hmm. Well, step up. This is how you do it. You know, it's one thing to record with your buddies in like a local studio. It's another to be on this level. So
professional, right?
That's right. And there's just a different level of playing and just this, the whole approach, how you conduct yourself and, you know, your consciousness, your entire mindset. So, yeah, John and I started the long process of learning how to make records for real then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jim turned us on to people that we worked with right off the bat. And they were older than us, you know, Greg Lease, if you know who he is.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of the most legendary musicians of the last 30 years. And yeah, we got Greg onto our first album. We looked for the older people.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
we
wanted to know who the players were and see if we could hang and if we could turn ourselves into our own versions of that and like just get in there with serious people. You know, Don Heffington, drummer, if you ever look up what he's done, Bob Glau, bass player, look him up. Hutch Hutchinson, you know, he's mm-hmm. been Bonnie Raitt's bass player mm-hmm. for a million years. He's done all these things. You know, the list goes on. We were lucky enough to work in studios like Ocean Way and Cello and the Village Recorders. I mean, I think about that now and it's just hard to, you know, sometimes it's like, oh my God, we didn't know what we had, you know?
And was that another situation of like learning by osmosis, just being in the room with and seeing?
Yeah, that's all we did. Yeah. I mean, there was no school of rock then, man, you know? Yeah. And I, you know, I couldn't read music. I don't know. We were just these guys off the street, you know, who I had a few tunes and could sing a little bit. And we just, I'm saying we, cause it was at that time it was John, Ginty and I, you know, and Gary, like that. We were like this, he was the manager. Gary was the manager and we were like the musicians and we were a team. You know, and the agenda at that time was my solo thing, which, you know, well, that's what it was. But, yes, it was just by osmosis and listening really hard and rehearsing really hard and trying really hard and just like forcing our minds into this place. And like, yeah, there was just tremendous purpose and intent to what we were doing, you know, cause speaking for myself, I was just like, I mean, it's just, I mean, everyone starts out as a local kid somewhere, you know, but,
Do you think you were particularly curious?
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
that's really all I had, you know. I mean, a little talent and a lot of curiosity, and it wasn't I'm not ambitious, but I was definitely
right. Yeah, there's a difference between
I wish I was a little more ambitious, but I was incredibly driven and obsessed, absolutely obsessed, nothing short of obsessed with records, how to make them, how to play, how to just do this. I'm still that way, really. It just never stops. I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking about some record, and I go to sleep and I'm listening to some record and I'm thinking about how to play still. And it's the same things that I was talking about with Davis Janes, Rick Medlock, Jim Scott, John Ginty, Chris Robinson, Todd Snyder, you know, Phil Lesh, Dave Schools, all of these people that I know.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all the same. I mean, Schools was texting me before, like, hey man, have you heard of this pedal? What about this record? I mean, you know, there's an incredible
the crew you just named.
Yeah. I mean, well, Dave Schools is in some other universe to me, but there we are, you know, we're talking about some like reggae album, you know, as if we're, you know, 17 and just discovered it. It's really, very little has changed.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, but I've rattled off enough at you.
I think we got where we wanted to go, though.
You got a lot. Yeah, well, see, it's easy for me to, when you ask it's questions, not,
well,
like, man, this,
well, you have a pretty impressive, I've done a few of these mentors segments now. And you, not that anybody, not to compare them necessarily, but
oh no, mine was the best. I'm sure of that.
But you,
I'm kidding.
You definitely have a serious crew of mentors. Like,
well, everyone is to me.
Yeah, definitely.
I consider everyone, you know, I really do. Like,
all talking about Davis and talking about Todd, like those people were specifically the sort of the truest form of a mentor to you, right?
Sure. And Andy, for definitely. I mean, but you know, like, I mean, right now Pete Sears is is here with the CRV. Yeah. And you know, I've been,
no doubt,
he's been with us for a week or two, and like, I can't get enough of hearing him play. I've already learned so much just from being with him for a little bit. Yeah, and the stories he has to tell are just are staggering. I consider him like an instant mentor, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's not that way for everybody, but I'm just blown away by music, and I think music is in such great shape, you know, right now. There's better players around than ever. I mean, they're just all over. Guitar players are it's like,
just gotta find them.
But I think it's easy to find them. I think we're in some incredible blooming period right now for musicianship anyway. So
that's great.
Yeah. So mentors, I don't know. Maybe I've been a mentor for someone, but I really don't think about that at all, you know?
Well, maybe someday down the road.
Well, it's just not something, I mean, no one sets out to be a mentor unless you're trying to be a teacher, which I'm not, you know.
Sure. Yeah. But maybe you'll encounter, maybe there'll be somebody that you meet down the road that reminds you of yourself, that you know, the same way that you affected people when you were early on starting out.
Maybe.
You
know,
they see that same spark and you see the same spark in someone else's eye that was seen in yours.
Well, you know, I mean, the one thing, like, I just produced a record for this guy named Zephaniah O'Hora, who has one album out that Jim Campolongo produced, and you know, really great. He's a New York country singer, really, in the classic style. He's very, very good, excellent songwriter, great musician, and he's got this crew of musicians that he works with who are so good. And he asked me to produce his record, and I did. You know, and that was a mix of like a couple of older musicians and a few of these young New York guys who are so good, impressive. But I felt like I was able to, I mean, I think Zeff asked me to produce his record as in some kind of mentor ish role, you know, because he respects me and what I've done. I'm older than him.
You're approachable still, though.
And he knows that I have experience in a few areas, like singing, writing, playing, you know, like, so that's
multi-talented.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just not like, it's not like I'm just a guitar player. I've written some tunes. I've been in his shoes, you know.
Right.
So I was able, I think that I was able to bring like some of my experience to his album. So I'm not calling myself a mentor to him, but it definitely had that angle to it, you know.
Aspects of it.
Yeah, it did. Like, okay, cool. This guy's older. He's going to produce us. And there were points where I could go, hey, a little less of that, a little more of this. Trust me, you know.
Been there, done it.
Yeah, you watch. You'll see this work, and it. Yeah, right. Got it. And you know, that's what that's what I've worked for all these.
Sharing your knowledge.
Absolutely, sure. Yeah. So that's where the experience does come in, and it can be something as simple as just telling someone to play a little bit lighter, you know, or play a little tougher, or just you know, take a rest here. It's usually like
a little suggestion.
Yeah, like a small thing that you can hear that makes a very big difference. And a lot of times it's subtracting something, you know.
The notes that aren't
played. Don't play that. Yeah. Just stop a little less. And that's those are usually the things that you end up with when you've been around for a while.
Well, I'm sure that's what you learn over the course of a
It is. It's usually it's usually to subtract, you know. Wow. So
well, again, thank you so much.
Sure, my honor
to talk with us. I'm excited for your sets coming up here tonight. You got
O'Teal,
CRB, and O'Teal.
Yeah, the ultimate mentor.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm sure he's a he had a great interview on our podcast, and
I've never played with anyone quite like him before. I just did one gig with him about a month ago, and I just thought, wow, I've played with some great bass players, but I've never heard anything like this.
Yeah, talk about special people.
Yeah, sure. And such a prince of mm-hmm. a human being, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah.
Well, best of luck to you and safe travels along the way.
Thank you kindly.
Cheers.
All right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Jambase Podcast. As noted, Jambase is pleased to be a media partner of the Osiris Podcast Network. Much love to Neil for chatting with us and to Telefunken for the mics. This episode and all others are produced by Jake Alexander, whose Clangin' and Bangin' Band provided our theme song. Finally, thanks to you, our listeners. Hit us up at podcast@jambase.com with any comments or questions. If you take the time to leave a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever podcast provider you use, we'd appreciate it. Until next time, go see live music.